Yeah, you know what you can get me, Pee-wee?
What?
El Hombre.
First of all, as a service to the listeners, this is an absolute forget about it.
El Hombre.
El Hombre is brought to you by LoanEstimateReview.com.
El Hombre.
He's a pariah. I mean, it's like going after raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens.
El Hombre.
We look forward to it every week here with Bob, Dave, and Moore. Every Tuesday at 5 o'clock, we bring in the one, the only, El Hombre, Michael Bradley. How are you, man?
What's happening, everybody?
Hey, I was looking at this story that you were tweeting, or retweeting, I guess, from Kevin Lytle, talking about among complaints from Colorado State athletes, staffers, coaches have told players not to report COVID-19 symptoms, threaten players with reduced playing time if they quarantine, and claim CSU is altering contact tracing reports to keep players practicing. Since then, there's been a bunch of players that have retweeted and said this is all nonsense. Who are those sources? This is BS. What do you know about this?
Well, I mean, what I know is what I've seen on both sides, and that's why I wrote if this is true, and that's why we always have to look at stories like this and say, you know, what is true and what is not. Look, with what we saw from another coach in the in a different conference earlier this week, in terms of a conversation with a player, if we're thinking that football coaches are going to be saying to their players who are on scholarship and whom they drive very hard throughout the year and whose lives they control very much, that, oh, geez, do whatever you want, whatever you feel, we'll be okay with it, I think we're being somewhat naive. There is certainly an institutional desire to accommodate students who are not interested in doing things because of COVID-19. But within the world of big-time football and even, you know, medium-time football like Colorado State, there is an expectation that you're going to play and you're going to be tough and you're going to do what we tell you.
Hey, what do you think about the job that Major League Baseball is doing right now? Rob Manfred, and you can see that there's still a little bit of animosity, Michael, between the players, the players union, and Rob Manfred, because he told them they need to do a better job with the coronavirus, which they do, and they seem to get furious over that.
Well, first of all, there's a heck of a lot of animosity between Rob Manfred, the owners, and the players. And it's going to manifest itself during the next collective bargaining agreement talks that are going to be as acrimonious, perhaps, as any that have ever been. And that's saying something for baseball, which has had several strikes. This is a poor job that has been done by Major League Baseball, because it has presumed from the beginning that allowing players to be somewhat free range throughout this would not lead to any infections and therefore not lead to any situations where teams are going to have to step away from playing. The NHL and NBA and Major League Soccer have done it correctly. You bring the players and teams into one place. You make them stay there. You test. You don't allow people to go out, and if they do leave, they must quarantine on their way back. And what do we have right now? Right now we have basketball and hockey playing unfettered so far. We have Major League Soccer getting to its semifinal rounds. And right now we've got baseball with two teams that aren't playing, and one, the Phillies, that had to take a week off because of a couple of false positives, but also because the typhoid Marlins came to town and infected everything. So this is a poor job. This is the very beginning of it. Teams are going to continue to travel. Teams are going to continue to mingle outside of their groups. And teams are going to continue to have people getting testing positive. The question is Manfred going to be able to keep this moving forward as teams have to step away? Or is he going to at some point be looking at six or seven or eight teams that are sitting out and say, we can't do this?
Manfred, I kind of like that one, Michael. You're welcome. So where do you think we stand? I mean, the seven-inning doubleheaders now, and I sit here and I – number one, I wonder if they're even going to get through the season, and as short as it is with 60 games. But do you think we're going to end up at the end of the season with some teams playing 60 games, some playing 56, some playing 52, that type of thing?
I absolutely think so. If we get that far, there's no way you're going to be able to have 30 teams play 60 games. Who knows how long the Cardinals have to be out? They're just finding their positives now. The Phillies played last night. They're rained out today because of the hurricane. But you know, we would assume that they're going to be okay. But what's the next team that's going to have somebody go out to eat or somebody that's going to interact with someone who's test positive? The thing that people don't really realize about this, because the information that has been given out on the macro scale has been so wrong and so afraid to be truthful, is that one person can infect 30. This is an exponential thing. When we were kids, the first thing we learned is how to add. Then we learned how to multiply. Then we learned about exponents. Okay, Avogadro's number, 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd. That's a big number. That's a lot of zeros. And that's how this thing works. It's not just once I infect one person, that's it. No, I go into a supermarket, I don't have a mask on, and I have the coronavirus, even if I'm asymptomatic. I can get 30 people. I can get more. And what people don't realize is, okay, so the players test positive, and they're asymptomatic, and they're just fine, and they're okay. That's great. But if you let them out into the rest of the baseball world, someone's going to get it, and it's really going to impact them. Freddie Freeman was lying in bed praying for his life. He's an otherwise very hale and hearty young man. Coaches would be exposed to it, training staff, people with comorbidities. And here's the thing you got to realize. When you're 24 years old, you think, I'm perfectly fine. I'm completely healthy. You don't know what comorbidities you have. You don't know what your heart is really like. That's why you have people sometimes when they're 20 years old who look like they're in great shape, who drop dead because they have a problem with their heart that has been undiagnosed simply because it's never manifested itself before. This is not being done well by Major League Baseball. And I can't believe that the NFL isn't sitting down right now and saying, boy, we can't follow the same path as baseball, because every single play, we have as much contact as there is, if not more, than in an entire baseball game.
I was reading what the Saints are doing. They're basically forming their own sort of bubble out there, you know, in terms of everybody staying in the hotel and limiting their interaction with others and that whole thing. Should that be something that the league puts into play? Because I think everybody's questioning, man, as close as the football season is, there's still a lot of time where things could get a lot worse in terms of the infection rates and things like that. So people are questioning whether the season will start on time, or will it finish at all, or what we're even looking at. Would you like to see that be sort of a policy across the league, where the way the Saints are handling this is how every team should handle it?
I'm astounded that it hasn't been put in place yet. There are billions of dollars at stake here. Forget the fact that the fans aren't going to go. The Raiders said yesterday, no fans at our games. There's going to be some places that try to have fans, 25%, whatever. That's a minor amount of money. The TV money is huge. And here's the other thing. When the football teams are playing, fans buy merchandise. Okay? Your team gets out to a 6-1 start. You're excited about them. You want a jersey. You want a shirt. You want a hat. You want something to show that you have your team, you're backing your team. When nobody's playing, people aren't buying stuff, because it's like, well, big deal. When are they going to play again? So there's so much money at stake here. I can't believe that the NFL hasn't said everybody's going to do what the Saints are doing.
Hey, Michael, Dan Le Batard had a little Twitter poll question. So Orlando Magic forward Jonathan Isaac, who tore his ACL, he's a guy who, because of his faith, is not kneeling for the anthem. And so he puts out there a poll that says, is it funny the guy who refused to kneel immediately blew out his knee? And I guess he took it down and apologized, but yeah, kind of a crummy thing to say. And, you know, if it was the other way around, certainly he probably would have gotten fired. But, you know, anyway, I just
he should have been reprimanded and suspended. It's not a crummy thing to do. That is crap. And you know what that is?
I can't say that word, Michael.
What's that?
We're not supposed to say that word.
It's garbage.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I apologize for using such a horrible word.
Yeah.
It is discriminatory. It is disrespectful. We live in a country where free speech is allowed. Jonathan Isaac chooses not to kneel. Jonathan Isaac also happens to be an African-American man. So it's not as if he's using his religion to in some way to appear or to be racist, right?
Yeah. Right.
So for Levitard to do that, it's irresponsible. And you know what? It's also, it's puerile. It smacks of the kind of nanny that you see 8-year-olds doing. You're happy that someone tore his knee because he didn't kneel for the national anthem? Really? He should be smacked. The ESPN should knock him down for that. That's poor. And here's the thing. You cannot be someone who says, I'm not a bigot, selectively. Mm-hmm. You're either a bigot or you're not.
All right, Michael, let's pretend you're Larry Scott. You know who he is?
Oh, yeah. Why are you doing this to me?
Okay, so you're the Pac-12 commissioner, and you wake up Sunday morning, and you're looking, you're thinking to yourself, okay, I'm going to go to the Players' Tribune and see what they've got today. And then you read the story about a group of Pac-12 football players from multiple schools threatening to opt out of fall camp and game participation unless their demands for fair treatment, safety regulations, and concerns over racial justice for college athletes are met by the conference. So you, Michael Bradley, you're Larry Scott. What do you do about this whole situation?
I'll tell you what. First thing I do is I convene a meeting of every athletic director in the conference, and I find out, I take the temperature of each school's campus. Then I sit down with them and I say, all right, I want 3 players or 3 athletes. Is this just football or is it all athletes?
It's football.
All right, I want 3 players or 2 players from your team. And we're going to bring everybody together, socially distanced, out in a park somewhere, wherever it's big enough that we're not going to infect each other, wearing masks, box lunches. We're going to talk about this. And I'm really going to listen. And I'm going to find out what it is because I'm going to tell you something. There's an excellent article in the New Yorker this weekend.
Hey,
this past
week, save jobs about 40%.
Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
I heard a drop there. There's an excellent article in the New Yorker this week talking about in the past when there have been pandemics and plagues. You know, let's go back to the Black Death in the Middle Ages. The Black Death, when it burned out, signaled the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance. The 1918 flu at 1918-1919 led to the Roaring Twenties, huge income disparity. Then led to the Depression. The end of this pandemic, whenever it comes, whether it's December, next December, 2 Decembers, is going to change the way we do things. And it's radically going to change college athletics. I think the Power 5 teams are going to break, Power 5 schools are going to break away. But I also think the athletes are going to have demand more of a say. And Larry Scott has a chance to get out in front of this. And he's not going to be able to give them everything they want. But he does need to listen. It's time to listen to the athletes because they're getting to the point where their arguments, their reasoning, and their causes are legitimate enough that they must be addressed.
I can get behind the causes. When you start getting into the 50-50 revenue split, that's where they're going to lose a lot of people.
Guess what? You know what? You can tell me all you want about free education. First of all, they're shunted into majors that are phony baloney in some way. Take a look at go get the West Virginia media guide and take a look at what they're majoring in. Okay, it's like hillbilly studies or something. All right, you're not going to get a job. So I don't want to hear that because the schools are making unbelievable amounts of money off of the football teams and off of the basketball teams, and Villanova completed a $775 million campaign. Fundraising campaign. They built all sorts of new buildings. They built an art center, dorms, the whole thing, refurbished the Finneran Pavilion. If they don't win national championship in 2016 and 2018, they don't come near that. And oh, by the way, it went way beyond what their original amount was. And now they've got one for the 2020s where they want to raise another $450 million. The athletes are driving the fundraising at a lot of these schools. So when you're raising $775 million largely because you've got people so excited about your basketball team and the players are asking for $4,000 or $5,000 a year or more, $10,000 or $15,000, and you're saying it's not right, well, then you don't tell me you're a capitalist because these folks are making money for the schools and they deserve a share.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with them getting a share. I've always been on the side of these athletes being compensated on some level for what they're bringing to the table. But when you start with, hey, we want half,
that's how you negotiate. You don't start with what you want. You start with something above it so you get what you want.
Boy, they started really high, though.
Aren't you married? Don't you know how this works?
No, I'm not. I don't know how it works.
Negotiate. honey,
I'm in the dark on this.
You really want to go away for a weekend? Honey, I want to go away for 6 days. Well, that's a lot. Well, how about four? Well, I don't know. Well, how about three and then this? Okay. You wanted three all along. Come on.
Jim and Dave, does that sound right? I'll defer to you.
There we go. The art. Here, I'm going to say you're married, right, Michael?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the more you give, the more you get. Am I right?
No. The more you give, the more you give.
It's always the happy
Come
wife,
on.
Happy life thing. Nothing
you,
rhymes
it's
with husband.
It's Surf City, right? What's the chorus of Surf City? Going to Surf City where it's 2-for-1. All right, 2-to-1. The more you give, the more you give.
Usually it's the other way around at my house. When my wife says she wants to leave for 4 days, I'm thinking, God, can you make it six?
Yeah, by the way, ding, 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 ding. Exactly. You start with 8, she goes to 6.
Yeah. Jim's wife does not listen to the show, Michael.
Thank goodness.
Nope. Excellent. She's going, evidently.
Yeah, well, I don't think so. She's upstairs watching a show or something. But she's going to Spokane for 3 days this weekend. I'm looking forward to it.
And you told her to make it 6 days, huh?
I'll tell you what, same thing. I got to be careful. But, yes, I understand completely.
Michael, getting back to the revenue share or split or whatever, what would that look like if they are getting, a good – I mean, if you're talking about, okay, let's put a few thousand dollars in their pocket so, they can fly home during, break and, pay their cell phone, stuff like that. But also the expense, I want to say that like at Auburn, the amount of money that they spend on the players, and you think like you take 60 guys on the road and, what is that, like 25 grand, as far as flights go, then, the hotel and with the trainers and the equipment. I mean, those helmets are now like $300-$400 a piece. And, would it get to that point where it's like, okay, you're going to get your revenue share, but there's also a lot of expense. Now I know they're making lots of money, trust me, but there is also a lot of expense, and it's a pretty sweet setup for guys that are there to audition for the NFL.
I agree, but it's also a heck of a lot of work, a heck of a lot of sacrifice, a heck of a lot of pain. And let's not make Auburn or whatever, school A out to be altruistic and saying, we love you. We're giving you all of this wonderful thing, these wonderful things. We love you as long as you help us win.
Well, yeah, they're taking care of their golden goose as best as they can.
This is not because they're saying we love our athletes and we want them to have the best. It's so that this is for the greater glory of Auburn, so that we can have...
Yeah, but it ends up being that way anyway, right? I mean,
right,
it is giving
so,
those
so you're
guys
working,
the best
you're the main... Look, the players had it stuck to them ever since they were deemed student-athletes so that they couldn't get workman's comp if they got injured on the job. That term was created to designate them first as students and second as students so that they couldn't be considered employees of the university, so that if they got hurt, they could apply for workman's comp. Coaches are paid exorbitant amounts of money and are allowed to travel, quit one job and go to the next one at whenever they want. There's a buyout involved, but that's generally done at the school level, at the department level. The players want to transfer, they got to sit out a year, and oftentimes they're told you can't transfer to any other program that we play or are going to play. Their scholarships are 1 year. There's no such thing as a 4-year free ride, a full ride,
right?
Okay? It's a renewable every 1 year. If a player is not performing at a level at which he is expected to, he'll often be told, well, you can stay on scholarship, but we're going to make your life miserable. You're not going to play, and you probably should transfer somewhere else. Oh, you've got friends here? Oh, you've got a girlfriend? Oh, it's close to where your family can come see you play? Tough darts. You're not helping us win. The entire system is stacked against the athletes, and because they're 18 to 22 years old and don't have the ability yet and don't have the time to really organize and get the power behind them and do something, they are completely at a disadvantage. I always used to say with my friend when we were sitting back in college, we would love to see a Wildcat strike before the Orange Bowl. We're not coming out until we get some of the TV money. And that wouldn't be easy to organize, but I would be delighted. I would gladly give up the Fiesta Bowl or the national semifinal while they're sitting in the locker room and they're making the people who run the whole thing sweat like they've never, you know, like they're sitting in a sauna dressed in an astronaut suit.
Well, hey, Michael, what do you think? If these Pac-12 players, if they're threats, or if they don't get their demands, do you think they'll stick together and actually boycott the season?
No. That's the toughest thing, is to get everybody to stick together. And, I mean, even professional athletes. If you read any history of the Major League Baseball labor union movement dating back to 65 when Marvin Miller took over and looking to 85 when they finally got full free agency, you are going to be told stories of Marvin Miller's trying to do everything he possibly can to keep everybody together because people wanted to cross the picket line. People wanted to play. People didn't want to strike. It's tough to keep the pros together, right? And they're are a lot more organized. You got your player reps, you've got a union leader, you've got other people who go to the clubs and talk to them. It would be almost impossible for the Pac-12 players to continue to stay strong together. I'm hoping that's not what Larry Scott and the athletic directors and presidents are hoping for, that, oh, we'll break them, bring them back under the thumbs. But their concerns about safety and their concerns about their health, they're very real.
Hey, Michael, I got to be honest with you. You must have learned more at journalism school at Michigan than I did at journalism school at Washington State, because I had to look up puerile. I looked up puerile.
I Googled it. I learned that in Latin class in seventh grade at the Haverford School. It comes from the Latin word puer, meaning boy, and it's a derivative of puerile of that. So I learned that back in seventh grade, and I didn't go to journalism school at Michigan. I got a history degree.
Okay. Well, do I get any credit for knowing how to spell it?
Concentrating on Soviet and Russian history.
Okay. Well, I knew how to spell it, but I didn't know that it meant that puerile means childishly silly and trivial.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm here for you.
Okay. Bob and Dave, did you know the meaning of puerile?
Nope.
No.
Okay.
I just let Michael throw those out there, and I just pretend I understand.
I thought he was talking about hand sanitizer.
You can count on that.
Hey, Michael, one quick question. A debate I've had with a friend here is Shohei Ohtani. I think he's being shut down for the rest of the year in terms of pitching. We'll see what's going on with him up at the plate. But he underwent Tommy John surgery in 18. He's a guy who was... He's got talent. He was Rookie of the Year in 2018. Then he suffers the injury. Everybody knew, I think, even before he signed, that he had something going on with the elbow that was going to require surgery. So it's not a big shock. Do you look at him as a bust at this point? Do you look at him as just a guy who 2.5 seasons, not even 2.5, into his career is unlucky? How do you view him?
It's too early to call him a bust, but it's time for him to decide to be either a pitcher or to be a hitter. And judging by the amount of trouble he's had with his arm, it's probably time to be a hitter. Because this attempt to be both, you know, it's fun when Babe Ruth was doing it back in 1918, 1919, but it was a different game back then. And this is a different situation. And he needs to decide what he wants to do, and he needs to do one or the other. Doing both is a fun thing to talk about, but it is proving in practice to be nearly impossible. And he's never going to be as good at either as he could be if he doesn't. I mean, if he's that great a hitter, put him in the lineup every day, let him hit 310, let him hit 37 homers, let him knock in 120 RBIs, let him have a WAR of 5.2, let him have an OPS of 912, right? Let him be a great hitter. If he's a great pitcher, make him a pitcher. Let him work out as a pitcher, build the legs, do the running, throw in the off days, chart the pitches the day before you're going to start. Stop trying to do both, because it can't be done. It's like trying to play offense and defense in football. You can have a package where you have a couple plays, but you can't do both. He should stop that.
He is El Hombre, Michael Bradley, with us every Tuesday at 5 o'clock. You can follow him on Twitter, at Daily Hombre is where you can interact with him at your own risk. Michael? Great stuff. We'll do it again next week.
So long, suckers.
El Hombre is brought to you by LoanEstimateReview.com.
That was a swish, Jim.
Hey, when you knew him before you came back to Seattle, did he do the same thing with the hang up of the phone?
Ah, man. I'm trying to remember where that started. He didn't do it initially. He didn't do it way back when I first started talking to him at Sporting News Radio because he used to write for the magazine, and we'd have him on for college football, and then he just became an everything guest. That's a good question, Jim. I don't think he did. I can't remember when that started, but I think it's worked out well, and that was a swish.
Yeah, that was a swish, you're right. Yeah.
All right. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the M's pitching in last night's 11-1 loss, and we'll hear what Scott Servais had to say about Justice Sheffield and his start. That's coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
The 5 o'clock refresh is brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, made to chill. Coming up in less than 15 minutes, we'll see what we learned today before we turn you over to the Mariners pregame show. Speaking of the Mariners, it wasn't pretty last night. They got walloped 11-1. And, Jim, you wrote a piece at 710sports.com where you kind of looked at the good and the bad so far this season. And I read that, and I think I pretty much agreed with you across the board. The bullpen's not been good. It has not been good, and we'll get into that in a moment. But I want to play what Scott Servais had to say, what Justice Sheffield had to say, because, Dave, you hit on it. He started out really well. He was looking really good. He talked about the A's, and their plan was to try to get him to pitch up in the zone.
I felt like they were trying to see the ball up. I felt like I could have did a better job of landing some sliders, you know, in the count. I felt like they were, you know, as soon as they seen it in the dirt, it was easy for them to lay off. So, you know, be a focus point this week to, you know, definitely land those pitches, especially early in the count, you know, give myself some wiggle room to work with.
And then one more from Scott Servais talking about Sheffield feeling like he felt like he was aggressive with his pitches.
I thought Sheff was really in control of the ball game. The first four innings, had all of his stuff working, was really aggressive. Good slider and a good changeup. It kind of all kind of changed a little bit. That long at bat that Chris Davis had, he eventually walked him. Then the inning started to pile up. I thought he had a chance to get out of it there. Obviously, Laureano got us again today with the big hit to kind of put them in the lead. And then, you know, trying to end the inning there was kind of when the game got away from us.
So you look at the box score and you go, well, man, it doesn't really look that great. 4 2/3, 4 hits, 4 earned runs, 2 walks, 5 strikeouts. Doesn't really tell the story because he did look really, really good. And then that inning, it all just kind of came apart. And the bullpen came in, threw some gas on the fire with Shaw going 1/3 of an inning, giving up 4 runs and 2 walks. He was a disaster. Groats was bad. He's been sent down. Cortez gave up a run. He walked 3. I mean, nobody that came out of the bullpen last night was good, and they all just contributed to the dumpster fire that was that pitching performance.
Yeah, and I was glad to hear Servais say that. I mean, look, I don't, you know, have the trained eye that, you know, Ryan Roland Smith does, but, you know, it was interesting to hear from him about what Justice Sheffield, you know, did have command, and he did have his chest out, and it looked like he was just being really aggressive and hitting everything that he wanted, the zone that he wanted to hit. And then, you know, as Ryan Roland Smith described it, he just tried to do too much. So I'm really looking for Sheffield to come out of this a lot wiser, and I can't wait to see him pitch next. I was probably more impressed by him than I was Taijuan Walker going 7 innings. Now, I know it doesn't add up if you look at, you know, what ended up happening, but, man, especially in the third inning when he had the 3 strikeouts, and I can't remember, was it Simeon? Somebody, he got looking, and you could see that the guy, he was like, wow, that was, yeah, he got me with that. So hopefully he can, you know, regain that. And then, you know, if Roland Smith is right, you know, that he just keeps it a little bit more simple and is able to kind of have a bounce back performance. I'll be really interested to see Justice Sheffield next time out.
Yeah, I hope he learns from it. And everybody talks about what a learning performance that was last night. And he did look, he looked great through 4 innings, like you were saying there, Dave. I was just looking at the plays from last night because so much happened in the top of the 5th inning. I just lost track of when Shaw came in, and everything got worse after that. And I wondered maybe Should have left Sheffield out there to try and finish up that inning and get through five. But Shannon noted on Twitter that he was up to 86 pitches, and you don't want to risk an injury, especially this early in the season. So it was probably a good move by Service to pull him out there. But a bad move to bring in Brian Shaw. Has anybody seen him pitch well since he got here? I don't think anybody's seen him pitch well in Colorado. This is a guy that got a three-year, $27 million contract back in 2017. And I don't understand. I mean, okay, go ahead, send Groats to Tacoma if you want. But he wasn't the worst guy last night. It was far and away Brian Shaw.
Yeah. To answer your question, no, I haven't seen him pitch well. I mean, he's had moments. He's got more velocity than I thought. We've seen him throw the ball harder than I thought he was capable of, but it doesn't really matter if they're whacking you all over the place or you're walking people left and right. It's just it's no good.
It's hard, though, because you watch a game like last night and you go, well, okay, Brian Shaw is not going to be on the Mariners 2 years from now when they're playoff contenders. And yet, in the present time, you sit there and you still want them to win. You still want to see good performances. And so it's hard to just kind of toss that away and go and just continue to focus on the young guys. But that's what we're stuck with this season.
Yeah, and to go back to what you were talking about, potentially leaving Sheffield in there, Scott Service addressed that.
Lariano is tough on the lefties. But, yeah, that's what we're trying to do, is give these guys those opportunities to work through it. You know, we've talked about that with our starters. Some of the guys have been able to get through it. Some haven't. You know, and it's the only way to learn is you got to go through the experience of it. And, you know, he'll be better next time for it.
Yeah. So, I mean,
well, then why didn't he leave him out there?
I don't know. Maybe it was the 86 pitches. Maybe. Okay. I mean,
yeah,
who knows?
Probably.
You know, I mean, again, this is a season where they, you know, they kind of laid the groundwork saying, hey, it's not about postseason. It's about developing the youth. It's about, you know, making sure they progress. And maybe part of that is not throwing too many pitches and not, you know, getting his confidence shattered. Yeah. I don't really know. But, yeah, the bullpen came in and all three of them were bad. You didn't get anything. And Shaw was the worst. I agree. The bats weren't there the way they otherwise have been. I mean, they struck out 12 times. They managed four hits. You know, the pitching, they walked 11 A's batters, 11 walks last night. So nothing really worked well. I mean, you know.
Are you guys worried about Evan White, or is it just 11 games and you go, okay, the kid is so great defensively. His bat's going to come around. You got to cut him some slack. He hasn't played above the double-A level, but, boy, there were a couple at-bats last night where I was going, man, he's, like you said earlier, Bob, he looked overmatched.
Yeah, Dave, I don't know where you're at with him. I think you've got the luxury of allowing him to try to work through it because he is such a value at first base, and you've already seen it, even though it's been, what, 11 games at this point. How many plays could you point to and go, wow, look how easy he made that. How easy did he make that look? I mean, we haven't seen that in a number of years. So he's bringing something to the table, whereas, and I know I always pick on him, but Vogelbach is a guy who's kind of a one-trick pony, where if he's not hitting, what is he doing here? He's not playing defense. He's not a pinch runner. He's not stealing bases. He's not bringing you anything else other than he's supposed to go up there and rake.
Hey, Bob, I thought of you when Malik hit that ringing double down the right field line, and then Vogie got chugging around second and around third and had to be held up, though.
So my point is that White is giving you something really good. I mean, he's saving errors. He's allowing these guys to, you know, turn plays quickly and fire that ball into the ground and know that he's going to be able to pick it or what have you. He's got a true value defensively. He just does look overmatched, and maybe that's they're looking at it saying, hey, we've got the luxury of leaving him out there. He can work his way through this at this level. I mean, there's no urgency to it because there's really nothing on the line this year.
Why don't you guys stop picking on the one tool player that is Vogelbach?
Would you call him the minus four tool?
What is the tool?
Or minus four? He can hit right-handed pitching.
Yeah, he can hit for power
occasionally.
Yeah. Occasionally, yeah.
If he connects, it's going to go a long way. He's got that ability, but man, he's hitting 105 right now.
Hey,
with Evan White, I would say, you know, it makes me temper, you know, how I feel about Kyle Lewis, because, you know, I'm like, oh, I think, you know, Kyle Lewis, this is enough to see that, hey, this guy's going to make it. And yet, you know, on the other side of it is Evan White. I mean, I would never go, oh, this guy's a bust. Because,
no.
You know, but his defense is fantastic, and that's what's, you know, carrying him forward. But it kind of helps me, like, with, you know, because I've been on the Kyle Lewis bandwagon, but, you know, he went 0-for last night, broke his 10-game hitting streak, and, you know, there's going to be slumps to come, and You know,
and he struck out 19 times. Early.
Seager, how about Seager?
Yeah,
2-for-3 last night. Man,
hitting
316. Pleasant surprise.
Very, very good with a .400 on base percentage. So, some good things, some bad things. Jim wrote a piece on it. Check it out at 710sports.com, covering sort of the good and bad so far through 11 games. We'll come back, see what we learned today. It's coming up next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wow, you sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
I was out for a couple of days, so I didn't really learn anything. So this is nice. I feel full again. I feel like we learned a lot, right, Maura?
Yeah, you'll definitely catch up here.
Okay, good.
I feel like you would come back smarter after having not listened to Jim and I for...
I was able to clear the fog after a couple of days. That's good. What did we learn today, Maura?
Well, first we learned that Jim and DK Metcalf have a lot in common.
If anybody knows what it's like to have a chip on their shoulder, by God, it's Jim Moore. I mean, you don't have that kind of output, that kind of career without a true chip on your shoulder, right, Jim?
No, you're exactly right about that, Bob. I've been doubted my entire life, and so I bring it a little extra every single day when I come here to work, and this morning was no different. I was show prepping like a fiend, I'm telling you.
I don't know why there's laughter. I would just think that people would be nodding their heads in appreciation for the effort I give out every single day.
I think we cut out the key part of that.
What was that?
Right after that, I said that the doubt is well-founded.
What was it that Danny used to call you, the workhorse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Workhorse Jim?
Yeah.
I get a bad rap. I mean, you know, even the listeners, you know, they text in, you know, maybe if you show prep. I show prep every single day.
You do.
Jim, you know what it is.
Jim's very good.
What?
You constantly doubt yourself. You constantly say, I probably don't know what I'm talking about.
I lack passion. I'm probably wrong.
You know why I do that? I hate listening to sports talk shows where the guy comes across like, I know everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just what? I mean, I used to call Salk a know-it-all, and I know it some. I know it some.
What do you mean, used to?
Well,
I was going to say, Maura Dooley just gave you thousands of dollars worth of therapy right there that you would have otherwise spent, and she put it very succinctly. Stop doubting yourself, Jim.
Okay. I'll have more confidence.
I'm kind of with you on that, though. I'm kind of with you on the know-it-all thing.
I'd rather admit if I don't know something than to try and BS my way through it.
Well, right. Listen, the show's about our opinion. You know, yeah, there are some facts to back up an opinion, but an opinion is just that. It's not a certainty. It's not, here's what I think should happen, or here's what I think of that guy, or here's my opinion on what we watched last night. Maybe it's in line with some people, and it's obviously not in line with others, because they're more than happy to let us know on the text line when we express an opinion that differs from theirs, and some will take it personally.
The 425 says drinking doesn't count as show prep, Jim.
That doesn't happen, 425. That just doesn't happen. Maybe at Edgar's occasionally, but yeah, it's all in the past.
What else did we learn, Maura?
We learned why Jim and Dave get along when Bob is gone.
Jim and I are very sweet to each other when you're gone, Bob, because he knows that all I have to do is say, oh, do you want to lead the show, Jim? So, yeah, we're very nice to each other. Very nice.
Oh, I love it.
It's just a different appreciation for each other.
Yeah. Well, I come in every time you're gone, Bob, and I think to myself, okay, Dave's leading. I know how that feels. I'm going to be the best teammate possible to try and help him through. That's my attitude.
Jim's like Stuart Smalley from Saturday Night Live to me. Was that the guy's name? You're good enough. You're smart enough.
Right.
And doggone it, people like you. Yeah, Jim gives me all kinds of, hey, great job. Only one more hour.
Yeah, and he does consider you. And I know this for a fact yesterday, Dave, because as I was driving, Jim inadvertently called me at the same time that he called Michael Bumpus. I don't think you realized it, Jim, but I was listening. And you said something along the lines of trying to connect on teams and, you know, let's not bother Dave with it. I think he's got his hands full with running the show. So you were taking him into consideration.
Aww. Correct.
Yeah. Jeez. You didn't know you called me, did you?
Well, no, I did. I saw that you were on that Microsoft Teams chat, but I didn't know how to just call Bumpus and Dooley, so I just went with what was on my phone.
Bumpus and Dooley.
I knew you were on vacation, but I figured, let's call him anyway.
You didn't hear me going, hello?
No.
Hello?
No, I didn't hear that.
Oh. So he was taking you into consideration there, Dave.
I really appreciate that about you.
What else did we learn, Maura?
I think that's the first time I've been called Dooley on this show.
I know.
I know.
That sounded weird. That felt weird.
Bumpus and Dooley.
I have had friends call me that before, but we also learned that El Hombre and Jim are in trouble.
I'm going to say you're married, right, Michael?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the more you give, the more you get. Am I right?
No. The more you give, the more you give.
It's always the happy happy life. Usually it's the other way around at my house. When my wife says she wants to leave for 4 days, I'm thinking, God, can you make it six?
By the way, ding, 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 ding. Exactly. You start with eight. She goes to six.
Jim's wife does not listen to the show.
Thank goodness, man. If she listened, you'd be on the couch, wouldn't you? Or you'd be calling Dave or me saying, hey, can I couch surf tonight?
I'd just be trembling in fear. Oh, no, I'm sorry, honey.
There you go. Throw some gas on the fire.
It was just for radio entertainment purposes.
Make it worse.
Honest.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah, I've offered up my guest bedroom for Jim many a time.
And I know where you live now, so it may happen.
I know.
Oh, yeah. Jim. By the way, Jim had an interesting response to one of our texters today that talking about singing, talking about your wife singing. I thought that was funny.
Oh, she loves Sheryl Crow, and she doesn't realize that she's singing along with it. But I'd listen to Sheryl Crow, but someone singing along to Sheryl Crow? Come on.
How's she sound? Pretty good?
No. And, you know, it's a hard one, though, because I'm sitting downstairs, I'm trying to get ready for the show, and I'm thinking, I don't want to go up there and ask her to quiet down because she's really enjoying herself. And so I just stayed down here and just listened to the bad singing.
And then vented to texters about it.
Yeah, that's the beauty. He's sharing that with the texters.
So is she a bad singer, then?
Yeah, and Jim, she admits that she knows she is. But, you know, when someone's singing and having a good time, boy, you're just a killjoy if you go up and say, hey, can you keep it down? I mean, you're not going to do that.
My wife, also a bad singer.
Have you ever told her to stop?
No. I made fun of her, though. One time when we were first dating, like, there was a song playing, and somehow it got turned down, and she was the only one singing. There was, like, four people in the car, and all you could hear was, woman! I don't know what song it was, but that just came blurting out. And so every time a good song comes on, I'll always go, woman!
That's awesome. Is that everything, Maura?
I think that's everything. Jim learned a new word.
Yes, he did. That's great. A lot of learning today. All right, that does it for us. Want to thank our guests, Ryan Roland Smith, John Clayton, and Michael Bradley. If you missed any of today's show, head to the podcast page at 710sports.com and click that podcast button, and then just click on our picture. Everything you missed is waiting for you right there. Mariners pregame coming up next. Justin Dunn taking the mound tonight with first pitch at 710. We're back tomorrow right here with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.